So move on today to the next mitzvah to discuss in the Torah, which is in the book of Vayikra, chapter 21, and discusses the prohibition of a Kohen becoming Tamei, ritually impure. And there's two different parts to this we'll discuss. There's the laws of the Kohen and the laws of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. They both have different laws, different ways in which they have to maintain this mitzvah. So let's start off slowly. A normal, regular Kohen is not allowed to become impure to a dead body. It's just called Tumah. Tumah is a concept, this impurity, is a concept which kind of, if we find very elusive, it's kind of strange to us. It's not a physical impurity, it's something spiritual. You can't feel it, it's not dirt, it's not grime. But when you come in contact with certain types of sources of Tumah, it actually affects the person in a spiritual way. The sources of Tumah, there are many sources of Tumah which exist. The primary one being a dead body, a deceased person. Certain dead animals would emit tumma. Certain emissions from the body cause tumma, such as a woman who menstruates, or after a man has sexual intercourse, will also emit tumma. A lot of these things emit tumma. The Kohen is only prohibited in tumas mes, tumma from a dead body. Other types of tumma, Kohen has no prohibition in becoming tamei. Now, what it means to become tamei is that once you've actually contracted this tumah, you can no longer perform the service in the temple, and you also cannot eat of the sacrifices, whether it be the sacrifice in the temple or the Kohen's special gift of truma, you also cannot eat. The Kohen gets truma as special food, sanctified food from the Jewish people, and he can't eat that food if he is tamei. There's nothing wrong with being tamei, essentially. It just prohibits you from engaging in these activities. However, for the Kohen, becoming Tameh from a dead body actually is prohibited. That's the one time Tumah is going to be prohibited to actually become Tameh. Anybody else who becomes Tameh, they're allowed to be Tameh, they have to refrain from certain activities. But a Kohen is not allowed to become Tameh from a dead body. Now, the way that Tumah is emitted from the dead body is interesting. It's kind of like its own scientific system. I mean, it's not scientific, and you can't detect it with scientific method. But there's like a physics to it. You know, certain types of tumah only could be emitted if you touch the actual source. Some if you carry it, if you sit on it, if you're in the same room as it, if you go over it. I mean, every single type of tumah has its own special rules and regulations how it works. When it comes to a dead body, a dead body will, if you touch a dead body, you'll become tumah. If you are in the same room, under the same roof as the dead body, you'll also become tumah. And the fact of being, that's called Tumas Ohel, Tumah of the tent. If you're in the same exact tent or under the same covering as the dead body, it also will cause you to become Tamei to the dead body. Now, what does that mean? When it comes Tamei from a dead body, is Tamei for 7 days. And after 7 days, the only way they can become pure is if they've gone to the mikvah in the proper times throughout the process, and also if it's sprinkled the ashes of the red cow, as you find in Parshas Chukas in the book of Bamidbar. Which means nowadays, since we don't have the ashes of the red cow, if one was to become tamei from a dead body, there is no way to purify yourself, at least not fully. So all of us who've probably been at some point in our lives in contact with a dead body at a funeral, under the same roof of the body, in a cemetery, so therefore, we're certainly all tamei meis. We've all become tamei from dead bodies, and you know we're stuck in that state until God provides us with the proper the red cow in order to purify us. Yeah.
Wash your hands, does that make you not
tummy
anymore?
No, I mean, it helps with certain things, not other things. I mean, the full tumas mace remains with you regardless. There's a concept that washing your hands takes off some level of tumma, it's customary, but it doesn't take away all the tumma, it's for sure not. A normal Jew is allowed to become tummy from a dead body, that's fine. Once you're tummy, you have prohibitions upon yourself that you can't do certain things, but it's okay to be tummy. A Kohen is not allowed to become tummy from a dead body, which means he cannot touch the dead body and he cannot be in the same roof as the dead body.
And not today.
Even today.
No, I'm saying
today,
if a person is tummy, what
can't they do? Oh, yeah, no, for us it doesn't really make a difference because it's really relevant to doing the service in the temple or eating of sacrifices. And since we don't do those anyways nowadays, then it doesn't really make a difference to us that we're tummy. But a Kohen still has a prohibition nonetheless. Now, a Kohen is allowed to become tummy for one of his close relatives. Meaning father, mother, wife, son, daughter, brother, and unmarried sister. Those are the exceptions to the rule. So in the regular Kohen would be able to become Tameh if one of his relatives dies. He can go to their funeral. he can involve himself, you know, in caring for that person's deceased body, and that'd be fine. And the other time it could become tameh is what's called a meis mitzvah. If there's somebody who has died and there's no one else to take care of this dead person, the kohen can step in and do it. And that actually is considered one of the greatest acts of kindness in the entire Torah, is to take care of a meis mitzvah. Because there's somebody there, his body is just laying there, there's nobody around to care for this body. Even the Kohen Gadol could go and care for that body. Even if he is on his way, the Gemara tells us, even if the Kohen Gadol himself is on his way to perform a mitzvah, he's on his way to give a bris to his son, or to bring the Pesach sacrifice, and he's also a Nazir. Nazir also is someone who can't become Tameh. Even so, for a meis mitzvah, for a dead body that has no one else to care for, he can go ahead and care for that dead body, despite the fact that he becomes Tameh, and it'll stop him from being able to perform his mitzvah. Doesn't make a difference. This mitzvah takes precedence. So that's considered one of the really the greatest chesed in the Torah, is this concept of meis mitzvah, of taking care of this meis, of this deceased person who has no one else to care for him. So that is the prohibition of the Kohen. Now the Kohen Gadol is interesting. The high priest, he can't become Tameh even for a relative. So for him, we're so strict that even if his spouse dies, his parent dies, his child dies, his sibling dies, he cannot become Tameh. He has to remain Tahor, pure at all times.
Except for
a Meis Mitzvah, yes, thank you. Except for a Meis Mitzvah. The one exception for the Kohen Gadol, like we said, is the Meis Mitzvah. That Meis, that deceased person, has no one else to care for him or her. For him or her.
Yeah, what about children? Children, you said earlier,
A regular Kohen is allowed to become Tameh for his children.
For children.
For a child who has passed away. Right, except the Kohen Gadol cannot. But the regular Kohen can. This poses many modern day questions, which I'm not here to resolve, but I'll just point out to you. Obviously, a Kohen at a funeral is a very, very risky business, because walking through the cemetery, even walking under a tree, which covers the cemetery plus the street, is problematic for the Kohen. So Kohanim typically will have a special designated area at cemeteries, or would stay far away. Entering into let's say they're having a funeral, in some sort, whether it be inside a shul, whether it be in a funeral home, and they bring in the casket with the deceased person inside, the Kohen can enter into that building, because there's a deceased person in the building. And those are two very clear prohibitions. Where it becomes a little bit more iffy is, what if a Kohen needs to go to the hospital to visit somebody? So hospitals at times, unfortunately, have people inside who passed away. And that's all under the same roof. So it's questionable if a Kohen can enter into the hospital if he doesn't have a really necessary reason to do such a thing. If it's relevant to anybody, I definitely tell them to go ask the rabbi, discuss it. Israeli hospitals usually have some sort of system to indicate if there is a dead person inside the building for this purpose. Obviously, American hospitals don't have this system, but a Kohen would have to certainly verify with the hospital and with the rabbi what they should do in that situation. Can a Kohen become a doctor? Since a doctor often will have to be involved in cases of people who maybe passed away or have to go to the hospital. I got the question discussed by great authorities. Is that a recommended profession for a Kohen? Yeah.
The prohibition that Tumas Mace, that's only for a Jewish corpse.
Even a non-Jewish corpse.
Even a non-Jewish
corpse. Yeah, so it's only a Jewish corpse we know for sure would cause Tumah being under the same covering. A non-Jewish corpse, if you touch it, certainly causes Tumah, and it's actually a dispute if it causes Tumah being under the same ohel. We try to be stringent even when it comes to non-Jewish corpse being in the same building when possible. But since that's a dispute, that allows for some room for leniency depending on the situation. It's a good question. One of the more recent issues which have made it, I think, in the papers is if an airplane is flying over a cemetery, if a Kohen boarded that airplane, if he knows about that airplane. So if it's a non-Jewish cemetery, there's a lot more room for leniency. If it's a Jewish cemetery, it's very hard to be lenient. There's room for leniency there as well, but again, a Kohen needs to consult his rabbi if he's going to board a plane that flies over a cemetery. The Gemara does discuss a concept of if you're inside some sort of other vessel, sort of box, they kind of block the tumah from affecting you. But that's not such a simple piece of advice. It's not so easy to apply, and definitely Kohen should ask his rabbi before boarding an airplane which flies over a cemetery. But like I said, Tumah has kind of its own physics to it. Where it can go, where it doesn't go, how it can burst through the roof or not go through the roof, or go out the window, not go out the window, enter into your box, enter into your box. There's long discussions about this in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, and you have to be well versed in these rules if you're a Kohen and you are involved anywhere near a deceased person. Okay, that's the overview. But these are all questions which are discussed and disputed. And any Kohen who has these questions should consult the rabbi. Okay, anyone here is a Kohen, to my knowledge. No. Oh, you're a Kohen. Okay. So maybe you've consulted your rabbi on some of these things. But you're a Levi, though, right? Yeah, okay. Prestigious family you have over there. Okay, good. So the question is, let's understand the concept. Why is it that a Kohen can't become Tamei from a dead body? Like we said, for a normal Jew, Tumah is okay. You're allowed to become Tamei. Once you're Tamei, there's limitations that you can do, but it's okay to be Tamei. For a Kohen, it's not okay to be Tamei. Why is that? So the Rambam writes, very simple reason. He says that practically all other types of Tumah, of impurity, would only put him out of the job for one day, typically. Being Tamei from a dead body puts you out of the job for 7 days. So you need the Kohen serving in the temple, and he's going to become Tamei for 7 days at a time, then you're going to lose your staff in the temple. And that's not a very practical thing.
The Kohen is not serving in the temple at
all. Well, I mean, it could be he'll be called in. I mean, there are times that they may need him. You never know when he's going to be needed in the temple. That's the Rambam says. So if he's not able to serve for 7 days, that could disrupt the temple service, and therefore, practically, the Torah prohibits him from becoming Tamei to a dead body. So Sepharno, one of the primary commentators in the Torah, he writes that the Kohanim we know were teachers of the Torah. And the verse tells us in the book of Malachi, the prophets, Sifsei Kon Yishmeru Das, that the lips of the Kohen guard the faith, V'Torah Sa'ashem Yivak Shem Yipihu, and the Torah of God we shall seek from his mouth. Kimach Shem Savakosu, for he is an angel of God. So we look at the Kohen as a messenger of God, teaches the Torah. When you ask the question, what did the Kohen do? If he wasn't serving in the temple, which they didn't serve in the temple all the time, like Phil's pointing out, you know, they had many weeks off during the year where they weren't serving the temple. So what did they do? They didn't have land to farm in the land of Israel. They studied and taught Torah, as the Kohanim did. That was their job. So when they were serving the temple, they did the service in the temple. And when they weren't serving, they would teach Torah. So the Sepharno writes that since they were the teachers of Torah, they need to act with nobility. And therefore, to be in any way, they have to be kind of cut above the rest. And even though anyone else is allowed to become Tamei, since Tuma certainly is some form of stigma, some sort of negative impact on the person, some sort of impurity, therefore they have to act a cut above the rest, more noble, more regal as our teachers and as the scholars of Torah amongst the Jewish people. Therefore, they will elicit respect from others, they listen to them. So he says that's why the Torah prohibits them from becoming Tamei. And it's a lesson for us. We discussed a few weeks ago the idea of honoring rabbis, honoring parents, we've discussed. And the idea of giving honor to somebody is that therefore, if you show respect, you're showing there's somebody of importance to whom I should listen, who I should follow. So if the Kohen is somebody who acts in everyday life, a cut above the rest, you recognize his noble place in Jewish life. And then when he teaches you Torah, you listen. You listen carefully, because really he's a very important person to listen to. So that is the explanation of the Sforno. Now the Sefer Achinuch writes another interesting point. And he says, overall, what is the concept of Tumas Meis, of a dead body causing impurity? What is this concept anyways? I mean, on the one hand, we accord great honor to a dead body. We take a dead body and we wash it. And the Chevra Kadisha does so much to respect, to show respect for the corpse. However, the Torah says, on the other hand, that corpse causes impurity. And the most severe level of impurity. So how do you reconcile these two ideas? The Sefer HaChinuch writes that according to the Talmud, a corpse is referred to as Avi Avos HaTumah, the grandfather of impurity. Meaning when it comes to the world of Tumah, like I said, there's kind of a physics to it. But you have something called a father, a source. You have a Rishon, the first level, the second level, the third level. It goes to the fourth level sometimes of impurity. And the dead body surpasses them all, and it's called the grandfather of impurity, meaning it's even further than a typical source. It's the strongest source of impurity we have out there. Why is this, he says? Because during our lifetimes, and we are alive and well, so our body is linked with our soul. And the soul is what causes the body to be animated, to be human. That's what a soul does for us. We see a life in the person. We see emotion, we see love, sensitivity, spirituality, kindness. We see so much in a human being when they're in their lifetime. And that's coming from the soul's impact on the body. But at death, what happens? The soul leaves the body, the physical body remains here, and the soul ascends to God. So what do you see when you look at a dead body? You see the part of the person which is the animalistic part of the person, the meat, the flesh. Like it says in creation, God created the human being from dust of the earth and breathed into him the nishmas chaim, the soul of life. So the dust of the earth, which is seemingly where the body comes from, and there's the soul from God. So when the soul of God leaves that body, what's left is dust of the earth. What's left is something very physical, very coarse, very, very animal-like. So therefore, at that point, we look at the body and we see something which drew us towards evil. Anything we did wrong in our lifetimes, it wasn't our soul's fault, it was our body's fault.
There are certain things that neshama leads the body and causes the body to sin. There's spiritual sin. It's not so simple, what you're saying.
Listen, neshama, without a body, the neshama would be doing everything 100% right. Without a body, without being in this physical world, the neshama would not have done anything.
And aren't there people who want to do spiritual desires, they want to be, they leave the body spiritual
motive. But that's not the soul. That's not the neshama leading them to that. That's something of beneath the neshama, some other physical part of the person leading them to that. The Gemara says that even when the Jews performed idolatry, it was always with some motive of physical pleasure, physical desire, physical gain, material gain. It wasn't a pure spiritual drive.
What about the one who challenged Moshe?
Korach. Call it psychological, maybe. I don't know if it's spiritual. I mean, there was jealousy involved. He thought there was nepotism involved. I mean, he had a lot of things driving him. But ultimately, we don't see that's the neshama which pushed him. There was something else pushing him. The neshama is a piece of a godly part of in the person. The neshama is doing anything wrong on its own right. It's because it's clicked into a body. That's what makes the neshama do wrong. So the Sefer HaChinuch writes that this is the idea of the tumah, the impurity coming from a dead body, which is that once the soul is dislodged from this body, at that point you end up with something which is the most physical part of the person, which is the animalistic part of the person, that part of the person which drove them towards anything they did wrong in life, and that emits some form of spiritual negative, you know, energy. Whatever this tumah actually is, it's negative energy which was you know, a spiritual negative energy which came from this body. Now there is a concept which is disputed if it's, you know, applicable halachically, practically, but there is a concept discussed that the body of a pious person does not cause tumah. Okay, it's not something we can apply practically necessarily. Some do apply practically, but the Gemara states in one place that the day that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi died, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the greatest rabbi of his generation. He was the one who compiled the Mishnah. He was the leader of the entire Jewish people. He was the president of the Sanhedrin. They said the day he died, batla hakedusha, the sanctity was eliminated, was canceled. So what does that mean? So some commentaries say it meant that the day he died, his body was so pure, it did not cause impurity, did not cause tumah. And even a kohen could have attended his funeral. That's what some commentaries write. Because the body of a truly righteous person is no longer animalistic. Somebody who's truly righteous and is involved in spiritual activities day in and day out, eventually their body becomes pure and spiritual as well. To the extent, now we have trouble understanding what this means, but Talmud says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the same rabbi who we discussed, even after his death, would come back to this world every Friday night and say Kiddush for his family. So somehow he reunited with his body, I'm not sure what that means, and say Kiddush with his family every Friday night. The Gemara says it. This is the Gemara in Maseches Ksuvos. The Gemara says this. So I don't understand what it means to reunite with your body after death. I mean, they buried his body. I don't know if he was pulled it out of the grave. I'm not sure what it means practically. But the Talmud says this. The Talmud said he only stopped because one time a neighbor found out. So he said, okay, you know, then he stopped the practice. But until that point, until the neighbors found out, he used to come back every single week and say kish to his family, even after he died, because his body was so pure. The soul was happy to reunite with the body because the body had become so sanctified in its lifetime. So therefore, that body, according to some opinions, does not emit impurity because that body became a piece of spirituality. It wasn't physical anymore. So that's the extent that a person is able to impact their body with their soul. A soul can actually impact the body to become something pure, something spiritual, something not of this world.
It's tumah. Okay, isn't this a spiritual condition,
yes,
rather than a physical condition.
Correct.
So the spirit becomes tamay, or the person becomes tamay.
Yeah.
But it's a spiritual phenomenon we're talking about. Right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, it's spiritual.
All right. So if you go in the presence of a physical body that's not alive, the person in there, the co-being, will become spiritually disqualified.
Right.
Right.
So we have an interesting balance here, like we said. We give tremendous honor to the human body in that it housed the soul during the person's lifetime. And that body is very honorable in that it housed the human soul. A piece of God lived in that body for hopefully 120 years. But also, on the other hand, that body is the animalistic part of the person. And that body will emit tumah. So it goes. We have a balance from both directions. Very interesting thing. So the regular... What? Attention. Right. I mean, the Chevra Kadisha is performing the greatest mitzvah, but becoming tamei at the same exact time. And that's what they're doing. Because it's the same balance or tension, as you're saying, between the honor we accord the body versus the tumah emitted from the body. So, again, practically, some authorities do say that a kohen would be allowed to enter into the grave of a pious person because that person doesn't emit tumah. Now, most Kohanim would not follow that, and again, practically, you can ask your rabbi if it's relevant to you, but could a Kohen enter into Maariv Machpelah, the grave of the patriarchs in Hebron? Could a Kohen enter into the tomb of Rachel, tomb of Rachel, in Israel? And all these, could a Kohen go into the tomb of any righteous person throughout the generations? So that's a question which is discussed. There are opinions that say yes, he could, because these righteous bodies do not emit any tumah. Again, for practical... For any practical questions, consult with your rabbi. However, the Kohen Hedjo, the regular everyday Kohen, not the Kohen Gadol, but the regular Kohen, is allowed to become Tamei for his relatives, we said. So why is this? So we would have thought that maybe it's some sort of honor for the deceased. Meaning, it would be a terrible feeling for a parent or a child if their parent or child couldn't attend their funeral. Right? For me to honor the deceased, we would think a Kohen is allowed to attend the funeral. But the Sefer HaChinuch writes an interesting point. He says it's not for the sake of the deceased, it's for the sake of the Kohen himself. He says that we know the famous quote, Derechea Darchei Noam, all its ways are ways of pleasantness, V'chol Nasiv Aseret Shalom, and all the paths of the Torah are peace. And the Torah is something which is challenging and difficult to keep, but it doesn't go against the grain of our emotions. That's what he writes. And there is a natural drive when somebody, God forbid, loses a relative, to cry, to mourn, it's important, it's therapeutic, it's necessary. We have to let out those emotions. And the emotions are there and they're real. So Sefer HaChinuch writes, the Torah recognizes very clearly human nature. God knows our nature better than anything. We know our own nature. God knows us the best. God made us. God knows what we do. And God knows it's a human need to let out emotions upon the loss of a relative, of a loved one. So therefore, God allowed the Kohen to become Tamei for a close relative, because God understood the human being needs that. It would be very unhealthy, very constricting, it would be very difficult to bottle up those emotions, not be able to attend the funeral of a close relative. And therefore, the Sefer HaChinuch writes, the Torah allows us, based on this concept of all its paths are peace, and all its ways are ways of pleasantness, that the Kohen would be allowed to attend the funeral and care for his deceased relative. It's very important for us to understand. You know, this phrase, all Torah's paths are peace, all ways are pleasantness. So, it's not saying that keeping the Torah is easy. We all know it's not easy. To follow every mitzvah in the Torah is difficult, challenging. It's very challenging. However, every mitzvah in the Torah, every challenge we have based on Torah law, is something that at least should fit into the grain of human drives, human emotions. It's not here to squash us and to constrict us. It's here to help us expand and help us channel our drives and our needs. So the Sefer HaChinuch writes, the Torah is not going to tell somebody who is in mourning, you need to bottle it in, don't attend the funeral, just forget about your relative. It's impossible. We're human beings, and the emotions are that we need to let those emotions loose. So the Torah allows the Kohen to attend that funeral and to care for that relative. However, the Torah teaches how to channel it. So the Torah gives us limitations in life to channel those drives, channel those emotions, but never to come and squash our natural emotions, our natural drives. It's interesting, because the quote-unquote religious perspective on death should be, why are you crying? The person's gone on to a better place. We all say that. We know the person's soul is now in a better place with God. You know, this world is a world of challenges. This is a physical world. So why are you, so this is a truly religious person, we would say, shouldn't mourn. You know, you shouldn't mourn at all, because what are you crying over? He's now in a better place. You know, you're so selfish. You want to have your parent here with you? Well, your parent's in a better place now. But that's not true. Because it is true, but it's not true. It's true that the person's soul is in a better place. But it's also true that we're human beings and we have emotions. And God isn't here to crush our emotions. God's here to show us that our emotions are real. And humans have real sensitivities and real connections to each other. And therefore, we have to be able to mourn and channel the emotions appropriately. And that's why we have a process of mourning. That's why there's Shiva. That's why there's Shloshim. That's why there's year of mourning for a parent. Because you have to be able to channel those emotions in a healthy way. Because the emotions are there and they're real. And Torah recognizes that. For someone to say, well, I'm on such a high level, therefore, you know, it doesn't bother me the person's passed away. Well, that we look at as a person's kind of callous in a certain sense. Because Hashem himself recognizes that a person should have these emotions. So on the other hand, you know, you do have times where a person is not at all close to, let's say there's an estranged parent. The person's not close to that parent. There's still an obligation to sit Shiva and Shloshim and mourn for that parent as well. And it's because the Torah is telling you also, even when your parent is estranged from you, that's still a parent, they still put you into this world, and you still should have these emotions. Sometimes the Torah dictates the emotions that should be there, even though we don't have them naturally. But when we do have them naturally, the Torah also tells us how to channel them. It goes both ways. So, I mean, it's always a fascinating thing. You do have times, let's say there's a child who's adopted. So his adoptive parents raise this child from birth to adulthood. When that child's biological parent passed away, the child has to mourn. Shiva, Shloshim, the full gamut of mourning. Even though they may have had no connection and they owe much more gratitude and much more love for their adoptive parent, it doesn't make a difference because the parent who physically brought you into this world deserves that honor. And that honor is due to the person who created you, who made you exist. So the Torah is telling you, even though you don't feel the emotion, try to develop in that situation. But in our situation is the opposite. So the Kohen, you might think the Kohen needs to squash his emotions. We tell the Kohen, no, don't squash your emotions. Those emotions are real and it's healthy. It's healthy to mourn. It's healthy what the emotions are. And it goes also for happy occasions. That's why we have Sheva Brachas, we have a celebrations for life. You know, there's an idea of having a festive meal for a bris, or a festive meal for a siyum. We finish a book of the Talmud, we make a festive siyum, or a festive a meal on Shabbos, or on a holiday, or a wedding. You know, we have these times we're supposed to celebrate, and Halakha mandates celebrating, because God says the emotions are there, emotions of happiness are there, so let them loose. Let them come out, because when the emotions are real and are there, I'll channel them in the appropriate direction. So Torah always recognizes human nature, Hashem knows human nature, and Hashem knows when we have to let those emotions come out. But now it comes to our exception. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, he is an exception to this rule that he is not allowed to come to Tameh to any of his relatives. So even though we said the regular everyday Kohen is allowed to become Tamei for a relative, and we just explain that's because human nature is that it's healthy to mourn without those emotions, the Kohen Gadol is not allowed to become Tamei for a relative. The Kohen Gadol would not be able to attend the funeral of even a parent or a child or a sibling or a spouse. He wouldn't be allowed to. Why is he an exception to this rule? So the Sefer HaChinuch writes on this point. He says that, you know, the Kohen Gadol is a unique, select human being who is a cut above the rest. He is the Kohen Gadol. He is supposed to be the towering spiritual figure for the entire Jewish people. That's how he's supposed to. That's supposed to be his model. Yeah.
Above Moses.
Well, Moses, and it's an interesting point. Moses, he didn't have any official status. I'm saying Moses is somebody who achieved so much; he became our leader. But the Kohen Gadol is somebody who is part of the. You know, every generation has their Kohen Gadol, and he is selected to be the spiritual leader of the generation.
In the hierarchy, would you say Moses has reached a higher level?
Moses was the greatest prophet we ever had. Moses understood probably the most Torah of anybody else.
He spoke to God.
He spoke to God.
Therefore, it seems to me, he's higher than the
Kohen Gadol. Okay.
Yeah, it's different.
It's different. Yeah, it's hard to rank. It's different because Moses is somebody who achieved greatness. God chose him to be the father of all prophets and the giver of the Torah. The Kohen Gadol is a person who, generation by generation, is modeled to be our role model. His role is different. His role is not to be a prophet. His role is to be a pious person. There's a difference to that. So the Sefer HaChinuch writes, is the Kohen Gadol supposed to be this person who's cut above the rest? He's supposed to be the model of spirituality, the towering spiritual figure of the entire Jewish people. He should be somebody who, even during his lifetime, kind of resides in a spiritual realm. Meaning his mind should always be on spirituality. His thoughts should be on Torah. He should be involved totally in godly pursuits. So in a sense, he's already in a different world, even living within our world. It's a very fascinating description the Midrash gives us. The Kohen Gadol we know is the one who entered into the Holy of Holies. The only person allowed in that room the entire year was the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. And the Torah tells us, the verse says, where is it? Sorry, I just want to make sure I quote it for you properly. It says there's no human being should be in the tent of meeting as the Kohen enters into the Holy of Holies. So simply it means that he's the only one in the room. Everyone else is supposed to leave the building. And he goes in, he himself enters in to meet God in the Holy of Holies. However, the Midrash says if no human being can be in the room, how is he allowed in the room? Right? It says no human being can be in the room as he enters into the Holy of Holies. Well, he's a human being. He's in the room. So the Midrash says an astounding description. The Midrash says that when he had the holy inspiration resting upon him, his face would light up on fire as if he was an angel. As it says that the lips of the Kohen guard the knowledge, like we quoted before from the book of Malachi, you should seek out Torah from his mouth, for he is an angel of God. So usually if he's an angel of God, we look at it as a metaphor. You know, he's somebody who's so holy and pure, we should learn Torah from this person. But this Midrash takes it literally, that at a certain point, the Kohen actually becomes angelic. I mean, on Yom Kippur, when he's entering into that room, he actually somehow flips into a spiritual entity. It's an amazing description. The Kohen Gadol is somebody who's supposed to be. Now, unfortunately, it happened that we had some corrupt Kohen Gadols as well. Especially during the times of the Second Temple, many of them were placed there by the Roman rulers, or by the Sadducee kings, and not chosen by the other righteous Kohanim, and therefore they were corrupt, and you know they bought the position, but that's not the ideal. The image of a Kohen Gadol is this image: somebody who is angelic, somebody who's supposed to tower above the rest of the Jewish people, like Aaron himself. Aaron himself was the one who was known as the righteous lover of peace, pursuer of peace, beloved by all, and that's the image of the Kohen Gadol. So therefore, since he is so above our world, the Torah doesn't feel a need to let him mourn for his relatives. Because for him, like we said, we usually understand the religious perspective, quote unquote, that the person's in a better place. Now, all of us say those words, but we don't really feel it, because we feel the loss, and we feel sad when we lose a relative. The Kohen Gadol, he says his words and he means it. He doesn't feel it. He's somebody who's already living in another realm. So if you're living in that realm, then what's the difference if the person is physically alive or spiritually alive? The person is here and well. And the Kohen Gadol doesn't need that outlet to mourn and to cry. He's somebody who we expect to be living on a different plane, and therefore the Torah does not give him the right to become impure in front of his relatives. Now, Rav Hirsch writes, furthermore, he says, the Kohen Gadol is a national symbol of the service of God. His home life, his family life, is not his primary existence. For all of us, we understand that our family life should be our primary existence. Our family, our friends, our community. Kohen Gadol is a symbol. He stands above the rest of us as a role model. He stands as the servant of God, representing the entire Jewish people. So for him, we don't look at his social life, his community life, his family life, as his primary pursuit. It's his godly pursuits. And therefore, for him, we don't give him a license to mourn. We think, you're with God right now. Forget about the family is not what's important to you. What's important to you is God. The rest of us know our family is very important to us. But for the Kohen Gadol, he is so far beyond and above our world, at least ideally he should be. Therefore, the Torah says, you should not be mourning. I think one interesting thing we see from this description is that God has different expectations of the regular Kohen than he has of the Kohen Gadol. Now, why is that? Because God knows every human being, and God knows the level every human being is at, and therefore God provides different expectations for each person which is out there. So I think we can apply that to ourselves as well. Every single one of us is born in a different situation, has lived different lifetimes. Some people have certain challenges, but other challenges. Some people have certain talents, but other talents. So you can't say that God expects the same every single one of us. You know, what is our battle to fight? So God understands. The regular Kohen has a certain battle he has to fight. He shouldn't become Tamei typically, but he needs to become Tamei for his relatives because I know who he is, I know where he stands. The Kohen Gadol is on a higher level. So for him, the expectation is totally different. His expectation is he should be beyond our world, out of this world. That's where he should be. So I'd like to relate it on a practical level to each and every one of us, based on an idea described by Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, a great Jewish thinker of a previous generation. He lived in England for a while, then moved to Israel at the end of his life. But he has a famous concept, and he calls it, everybody has, in Hebrew he calls it, the kudos habachira. Everyone has their point of free choice, which means the following. Let's take a murderer. A murderer wakes up in the morning, and he actually has a struggle. Should I murder someone today or not? And he has to make a choice. You know, he's ready to go murder. He has to choose, shall I murder or shall I not murder? And he's struggling inside. Should I pull the trigger or not? Now, hopefully, I hope, all of us in this room don't have that decision to make. You know, we don't struggle with that. It's not a question in our head, should I murder today or not? We're not making that as an active decision daily. It's something which is obvious. That's not what I do. So that's not what we call where you have free choice. Because, I mean, yes, you could choose to murder, but you're not grappling with that decision. On the other hand, let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Let's take, you know, a Gadol Hador. Let's take a leading rabbi of the entire generation. So let's, you know, somebody like Rabbi Eliyashiv Zatzal. Rabbi Eliyashiv was someone known to have studied Torah about 20 hours a day or so. Ate very little. He helped people. He advised people. He davened. And he stopped. Right? So he's not grappling with a lot of things we grapple with. What's he grappling with? Should I sleep today for 2.5 hours or for 2 hours and 20 minutes? You know, so maybe I can learn 10 more minutes of Talmud somewhere in my day. That's his battle. Or, you know, but then everyone else is somewhere in the middle, right? So most of us, we're grappling with, you know, every of the issues. Should I lose my temper or not? Should I say Lashon Hara or not? You know, when I pray, how much Kavanah, how much intent do I have? Shall I take revenge on this person? Shall I lie? Shall I cheat? Everyone has their own little struggles they have. Should I cut corners over here? Cut corners over there? How's my Shabbos observance? Am I keeping that rule, this other rule, this halacha, that halacha? Everyone has their own struggles. Everyone's on their own level. But that's our playing field. Our playing field is where we are. Everyone has their own playing field that they're at. You know, I think it's, you know, literally like a battle. So you have two militaries fighting, and one military pushes back the other military. So this area is conquered. This area far beyond, which we're not talking about yet, that's not our battle. But there's a line of battle, and that's what we're struggling with. So every human being has their line of battle. And what you're expected to do is know where your line of battle is, you're supposed to push forward. Don't fall back. But I can't expect you to be fighting a battle over there when you're still over here. So every person has their expectations based on who they are, based on their upbringing, based on their education, based on their talents, based on their capacities, based on their challenges in life, based on their productivity in life. Everyone has their own personal battles they fight. And it's important for us to understand where our battles are and push. You know, like football as well. Football, you get past the 30-yard line, the 40-yard line, the 50-yard line, back, back, back. You keep pushing forward to the end zone. You don't want to fall backwards. You want to keep pushing forwards. So everyone has to have their lines drawn where the battles are, recognize what their battles are, not fight the battle which is far beyond them, not reconquer the wheel from the battles behind them, reinvent the wheel from the battles behind them, but conquer, you know, their battle line where they are right now. So that's Rav Dessler's point. But I see that very much as a lesson of the Kohen and the Kohen Gadol. Because God says, your battle is here, your battle is here. And you don't need to fight that battle, and you shouldn't be fighting this battle. Everyone needs to fight their own battles.
Quick question.
Yeah.
How many more minutes do
you have? We'll try to make it 3. How about that?
Give me an idea. How many minutes?
I'll try to make it to 3 minutes. I'm late anyway, so you know, I don't want to go too late, because I have to also go. But I just want to finish one more point. So if you have to go, you know, I won't be offended if you have to leave.
I want to meet him.
What? You might miss something.
I want to
so that's why I want to add in this one point relevant to Hanukkah. Hanukkah begins next Tuesday night. And the Hanukkah is a miracle which occurred through the hands of Kohanim. The discussion is Kohanim. In Hanukkah, we know that the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, they were of the family of the Kohanim, as we say in the prayer, in the days of Matisyahu, the son of Yochanan, the high priest, the Hashmonaim, the Hasmonean family, and his children, they're the ones who fought the Battle of Hanukkah. They're our leaders. And the rabbis tell us that the famous jug of oil they found was sealed with the seal of the high priest, of the Kohen Gadol. So we have to understand the story of Hanukkah wasn't just a physical battle of the Jews versus the Greek army. It was an ideological battle. It was an epic ideological battle between Jewish philosophy and Greek philosophy. Jewish wisdom and Greek wisdom. Something which we can elaborate much more on over the next few weeks as we discuss Hanukkah. But one point made is that the commentaries point out, especially the Maharal points out, that it's very specific that the Kohanim were the ones to fought this battle. And it's the fact that the Kohen Gadol's oil was the famous oil of Hanukkah is very symbolic and meaningful. And I'll say this in short, and maybe we'll talk about it more in future weeks, that the difference between Greek philosophy and Jewish philosophy, again, it's a very complex discussion, but if you boil it down essentially to one main point. I mean, Greek philosophy, and when I say philosophy, I also mean Greek culture. I mean the foundations of science and mathematics and philosophy and architecture, everything which Greek society stood for, which to this very day still impacts us. We call ourselves, you know, Greco-Roman society. We were impacted by the Greeks and the Romans. What that was all about using the human mind, human intellect, to do the best we can to understand and improve our world. You know, they did good things. They discovered a lot. They made beautiful structures, beautiful arts, and science. The foundation of scientific thought was really found in ancient Greece. The problem we have with this is that everything they did was purely limited within the confines of this world. Meaning they're within the bubble of our physical world. Everything they said was right. Whatever the human mind can determine is truth, what the scientific method can determine is truth, you can prove through hypothesis and experiments, trial and error, cause and effect, that's truth. We try to beautify buildings, beautify our bodies, because that's everything which is within our physical world. These are things which the Greek society was able to perfect and to develop. And that's what they stood for. The Torah's system of thought tells us that it's very important to understand how the world works, but we have to keep in mind that this whole world is merely the creation of God. And we think that there's an absolute value that 2 plus 2 equals 4. And that's not absolute according to Torah thought. 2 plus 2 could have equaled 5. But God deemed it to equal 4, so now it equals 4. Now our minds can't even fathom such a thing. We can't. We can't fathom such a thing because we live in this physical world. But our minds are also fashioned by God as limited tools, and our minds can't understand everything. But the classic discussion you have amongst very early Jewish thinkers is that the Greeks would say the Olam is Kadmon, that the rules of this world precede all. And we say, no, God precedes all. I mean, do we say the laws of physics, science, and biology, mathematics are absolutes, and God works within those laws? Or do we say that, no, God is the absolute, and everything else is really determined by God? Does gravity have to be so? Does 3 plus 3 have to equal 6? Does it have to be this way? So the Torah thought says nothing has to be anything besides God. Everything else is God's creation, God's decision. So Greek culture and Greek society, they stood for the fact that within our system, we can conquer, determine all, but if the human mind cannot understand it, if it cannot be boiled down in a test tube or through a mathematical formula, it can't be true. It's irrelevant because it's not within our world. Jewish thought is that it's good to determine as much as we can within our world, but the rules of this world are created by God. And there's a whole system out there beyond our world which can supersede this world, precede this world, transcends this world, defines the world, and that goes far beyond. So we talk about the Kohen Gadol being the hero of this story. The Kohanim, and essentially the Kohen Gadol's oil, is the hero of this story. The Kohen Gadol is the one who we said lives his life beyond our world. He doesn't mourn for relatives, because he's saying that, I understand that it should be sad when relatives die, but the Kohen Gadol is someone living in that other world. He's living in God's world. And he says, to me, the fact that a person passed away is irrelevant, because their soul carries on, and their soul is in the next world, and I'm in the next world too right now. He's somebody who actually lives the life of somebody who can see beyond our world. The power of the Torah, the power of the high priest, of the Kohen, that's what really creates the Hanukkah story. Because the Hanukkah story is really this epic battle of Greek society versus Jewish thought. And Jewish thought is that we have to see that there's something that goes far beyond the confines of this world. The Kohen needs to cry at a funeral, but the Kohen Gadol does not need to cry at a funeral. Kohen Gadol is somebody who understands that this physical world is limited. On Hanukkah, oil which can burn only for one day burns for 8 days. Because we don't need to follow the rules of physics. It's not necessary. Because God determines those rules. Typically those rules do apply, but sometimes they don't apply. The Greek would say it's impossible. No, if these are the rules of science, then you can't have, miracles can't occur. Can't be. The Torah says that miracles are just as, expected as science, because it's all coming from God anyways. What's the difference? So I'm saying this all in short. Hopefully we'll elaborate more on this in the next week or two. We'll talk about it before Hanukkah and on Hanukkah. But the parallel I'd like to draw is that the Kohen Gadol's power is the key to understanding what is it that we have to do to overpower that the Greek army. The Greek army tries to teach us that there's nothing beyond our world, nothing can't be explained in scientific terms. And the Kohen Gadol tells us that there's a way to live understanding that there's something far beyond our world, a different realm, a realm of God, a realm of spirituality. And that realm goes far beyond the rules of science and nature. And as important as those are to understand, you can't limit yourself to those rules.